I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in partnership with the team at Side Effects, we're going to explore a fascinating story that walks the fault lines of law, medicine, and ethics. It involves the case of a doctor who allegedly provided false medical reporting in court cases. My guests are former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randall Shepard, Dr. George Parker of the Indiana University Department of Psychiatry, and Steve Berger of WNIN, who reported the story with Side Effects. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about a fascinating story today that takes us into some tricky areas of law, medicine, and ethics. It's a product of our partnership with the good folks at Side Effects. We've done some fine reporting on fraudulent mental health reporting to the courts. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are public media reporter Steve Berger of WNIN, former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randall Shepard, and Dr. George Parker of the IU Department of Psychiatry. Welcome to all of you. I guess in Chief Justice Shepard's case, it's welcome back, but welcome to everyone.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Now, I got to say, I was a little bit perplexed by this because normally, as I was saying before we went on the air, I try to boil down what this show is going to be for the billboard and the promos we do to a sentence. This one is almost impossible to boil down to a sentence because the issues are fairly complicated, which means we get to earn our reputation as talk radio for people with attention spans. So I think probably the best way to illuminate all of the directions that this conversation could go is to play one of Steve's stories that sort of sets up what the issue is and what set it off. We're going to listen to that story now.
This story actually begins at a tree on a curve on Indiana State Road 46 east of Bloomington, where Albert Fink crashed his 2012 BMW sedan. What Fink didn't know is that two Indiana State Police detectives were right behind him that day. ISP Sergeant Kurt Durnell says the detectives encountered a strange situation. Fink told them the crash was deliberate.
Once they realized what had happened, they had a conversation with Mr. Fink.
And what happened?
What was it about? You know, I'd say it was not ordinary, and that his intention was to commit suicide right here on the strip.
Fink had been on his way to testify as an expert witness at the arson and explosives trial of Caleb Loving. Vandenberg County Prosecutor Nick Herman, who was trying that case, says his office got a call from a state trooper who said,
"Hey, you know, this doctor was in an accident, and he says that he falsified a report and he was going to be called as a witness the next day." We quickly realized that that was the trial we were in.
Dr. Fink had filed a report that said Loving was mentally competent to stand trial. The only problem was he'd never met Caleb Loving. Loving's defense attorney, Stephen Owens, says he'd already been suspicious of Fink, who was reluctant to testify about the competency exam he said he performed.
So I talked to him probably three times, and each conversation got a little more odd. I would have described that those conversations as squirrely, I guess is the way I would have described it. After that, I started looking into jail visitation records and discovered that there was no listing of him being there.
85-year-old Albert Fink is a psychologist often hired by the court. He's performed dozens of these evaluations over the last 10 years. The judge declared a mistrial in Caleb Loving's case, but Fink's scene-of-the-crash confession called into question not only the trial he was slated to go to, but everyone he'd ever worked on. Herman says it prompted a massive, months-long investigation.
It was a large effort, and a lot of different agencies participated in and helped with that investigation. It was a troubling case in that you had a person that is literally hired by the court to come in and testify about something that, you know, is lying.
Almost a year to the day after he crashed into the tree, Dr. Fink pleaded guilty to a felony charge of obstructing justice. He received probation and had to surrender his professional licenses. So, Albert Fink was caught and punished. But, according to Owens, here's the scary part.
If Albert Fink had not crashed his car and admitted to the officers that he falsified those mental evaluations, would he have ever been caught?
I'd have to say maybe. And whether it would have been this case or not, I don't know. I'd like to think that somebody, at some point, would have caught up with him. Obviously, we didn't catch up with him all these other cases.
How many other cases? Side Effects has obtained a list of cases that turned up during the investigation in which Albert Fink is suspected of possibly falsifying the exams. For Side Effects, I'm Steve Berger.
That was one of our guests, Steve Berger's, reporting on the case of Albert Fink. And some of the outcome here, Steve, is in the story that obviously he entered a plea of guilty and to obstruction of justice. We tease a little bit, and I know you've done more reporting on this, and I would encourage our listeners to go to the Side Effects site and look for your stories. But how many other cases was he involved in? Can you give us a ballpark number where there might have been some doubt about the quality of his testimony?
The cases in which there is some doubt about the quality of his testimony, there was a list of 29 cases that investigators, the Evansville Police Department, came up with, in which they couldn't determine if he'd actually seen the defendant to do the evaluation. And they went through those, the prosecutor, Nick Herman, and Steve Owens, the chief public defender in Vandenberg County, and decided that there wasn't enough evidence that something, another outcome had happened, so they did not decide to pursue any more charges.
And we probably, because this is a complicated issue, walk through a couple of basic points here. Chief Justice Shepard, we'll start with you. We establish significant disincentives within the legal system for people to lie under oath, right?
Yep. Same as for theft and burglary, yeah. Kind of that sort of incentive. Yeah,
so, I mean, technically, he pled guilty to obstruction of justice, but if he lied in any of those other cases, he could have been subject to perjury charges too, right? Or am I mistaken there?
Certainly, if he'd come and testified under oath, he could have. I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to the question whether perjury applies when you supply a written report and simply sign it. You would need. It depends on how you signed it. So the answer is maybe yes and maybe no.
Okay. What's the distinction when you say how he signed it?
Well, all of us confront documents in our ordinary lives, yeah, where we say, I certify that the above is true under the penalties of perjury. We sign our names, and that would subject you to a perjury prosecution. My guess is most of these reports don't say that.
Yeah.
They do not.
And Dr. Parker, again, I'm just trying to establish a baseline as we get into the more thorny issues here, too, that there are professional ethical guidelines here that, among other things, medical professionals aren't supposed to diagnose people they haven't even seen, right?
Well, yes, that's a good starting point. And yeah. Dr. Fink is a psychologist, so doesn't fall under medical ethics, strictly speaking. But certainly the American Psychological Association has guidelines for ethical behavior, and that includes basic things like patient confidentiality and, of course, telling the truth is, I think, expected. With regard to the how we sign our reports, it's usually with a reasonable degree of medical certainty or psychological certainty, and not under pains and penalties of perjury. So it's interesting that Dr. Fink was caught when he was going to have to testify, which means he would have had to be sworn in and thus be subject to it. And I suspect that none of the other cases had led to testimony.
They just took his reports. And
that's often the case.
Okay. And entered those. So, Chief Justice Shepard, what are the safeguards that are in place then for written reports or evidence such as that? Where technically it's being entered, but not necessarily under oath.
Well, one of the most important safeguards we haven't mentioned yet mm-hmm. is that these determinations aren't made on the basis of a single report by a mm-hmm. single psychologist or psychiatrist. The requirement for determining whether somebody's competent for trial is that two such people investigate the question of whether this is a competent person. So one of the things that the prosecutor and Steve Owens would have looked at is mm-hmm. They'd look at cases where there mm-hmm. was a disagreement between Dr. Fink and the other appointee, the other mm-hmm. person who did the examination. That'd be the ones you'd worry about, where mm-hmm. where Fink said, yes, he's competent, and the other examiner thought otherwise. Those would be the cases where an actual injustice mm-hmm. might be caused. But that's a major and important feature of how these investigations get conducted.
Dr. Parker, what is the standard for determining that someone is competent? And I know this is part of Steve's second story, but...
Well, the standard comes from a United States Supreme Court decision called Dusky, mm-hmm. and it's whether a defendant has the capacity to understand the nature and objectives of the proceedings, the criminal case against him, and whether he can assist his attorney in his defense. It's a fairly basic standard. It's not a very high bar.
Mm-hmm.
So people who can be actively mentally ill and still meet the criteria for competence to stand trial. With regard to the earlier point about the Indiana system of two reports mm-hmm. being, two evaluations being done, the most common scenario where I testify about competence is when I've disagreed with the other evaluator.
Mm-hmm.
So it suggests that Dr. Fink's reports often agreed with the other evaluator,
mm-hmm.
whether that's by luck or just because he
Do you
was
see
consistent.
Each other's work? Or?
No, we do not.
Okay.
The
so
only
it's
time
a blind
we find
system.
Out about the other evaluator is okay. when we show up to testify and say, oh, what'd you say? What'd you say?
Okay.
And then we can talk about it. But until then, the only contact I have with the other evaluator is, oh, I got these records, or the family said this happened, and sometimes I pass that on to the other evaluator.
So take me through real quickly. Let's assume here that I have been accused of something really, really heinous, and you have to determine whether I am competent to stand trial. What would that process look like? What sorts of questions would you ask me? What things would you be looking for?
Well, first off, most of the people that I evaluate have not been charged with anything heinous.
Okay.
They're often charged with misdemeanors or low-level felonies. The things I would look for, well, I would do a psychiatric evaluation. I would go over your background history. I would do a mental status examination. I'd try to come up with a diagnosis. And then I would try to run through the elements of what the profession has felt to be pertinent for, is somebody competent? So what are your charges? What could happen to you because of those? What does it mean to plead guilty, not guilty, or even insanity? What are the roles of court participants? Have you met with your lawyer? Do you understand what's going on in court? Has there been a talk of a plea bargain? How does a plea bargain work? What do you think is going to happen in the case? Based on those answers, I can usually come up with a pretty decent sense of whether that person is going to be competent. Often helpful to talk to the attorney, the defense attorney in particular, and often helpful to look at records as well. Then I write a report, I send that off to the court, and usually I don't hear anything more.
Chief Justice Shepard, how often are people deemed not competent to stand trial?
Well, as a percentage of the whole, it's incredibly small, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, most people who walk in the door are people about whom there's no question that they're competent. So we begin with a pretty small group. The number of people who get sent for evaluation, interestingly, at least my trial court friends tell me perhaps half the time they're sent there because both the prosecutor and the defense lawyer think mm-hmm. that this is somebody who needs to get a close look. So there's a fairly high level of cooperation and a very small number of contested hearings where you bring in the two experts. Couldn't be 1%.
We are talking about a complicated case involving law, medicine, and ethics on No Limits today. My guests are Steve Berger, former Chief Justice Randall Shepard, and Dr. George Parker, the IU Department of Psychiatry. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about some good reporting from our friends at Side Effects on fraudulent mental health reporting to the courts. It's a complicated question. Our guests, fortunately, are experts in the area. We're talking with public media reporter Steve Berger of WNIN, who did the reporting on this story, former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randall Shepard, and Dr. George Parker of the IU Department of Psychiatry. We've gotten an email question from a regular listener named Jerry, and if you want to join this conversation, you can do what Jerry did and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or call us at 866-476-3881. Jerry writes, in the opinion of today's guest, is it wise to rely upon the judgment of a single practitioner's assessment of a person's mental health? We've already pointed out that it has to be two. Would not a panel of 3 to 5 experts independently appointed and independently reporting their conclusions better serve the cause of justice? If the answer involves expense, please explain precisely how we should calculate the cost of justice for all compared to the costs of injustice. Probably before we get into the last part of this, the larger philosophic question there, ought to point out, and we were talking during the break, Dr. Parker, about the fact that that often there it isn't limited to just two practitioners, and it is always two practitioners, right? There is that
right. Indiana statute requires that at least two evaluators be appointed to evaluate a defendant, and they can be. The evaluators can be either PhD level psychologists or psychiatrists. Some judges prefer to appoint a panel of three. It's not very common. And some judges will bring in a third evaluator if the first two evaluators disagree. The limiting factor for a lot of courts is the cost. We charge hourly rates, and we're in the court's scheme of things, we're expensive. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to budget for it, and so there are often special requests made to the county boards for the money to pay for these evaluations. So the idea of a panel would be wonderful, except it would be hard to get 3 to 5 mental health professionals to agree on anything, starting with the diagnosis and then ending with the question of competence. And actually, Indiana is unusual. Many states only require one evaluator, and they do rely on that one evaluator. And in some cases, I think Florida, they allow social workers to do competence evaluations for misdemeanor cases. It's hard to find evaluators to do this kind of work. Justice Shepard, I'm sure, can share the judge's perspective on that.
Before we get to the tortured question, you say that that the evaluations are expensive because you charge an hourly rate. Is that a rate set by the state or is it set by the psychologist or psychiatrist?
It's set by the individual practitioner.
Oh, okay.
Indiana does not have a centralized system in any way, shape, or form for these evaluations. And the judges appoint people that they are familiar with, mostly that have worked for them, that they have found are able and willing to do this work. So it's very much a Rolodex kind of a process.
Well, the judges say that one of their main problems is finding enough people who are willing to actually perform these.
That's true even in Indianapolis.
Well, it's when I was a trial judge, you could count the number of psychologists and psychiatrists on one hand who were even possibilities that you could recruit to do an evaluation. And the judges there, and I gather in Indianapolis, would say the same thing, that the number of people, certainly in psychology, and I would assume in psychiatry as well, who do these is very small indeed. I mean, Dr. Parker's too modest to mention the fact that people bring clients from all over Indiana to Indianapolis to be examined by him, partly because of his talent, but also because they're willing to put somebody in a sheriff's vehicle and drive them all the way to Indianapolis if they can't find anybody. And even in a city like Evansville, you get a very short list.
Right. What accounts for that unwillingness? I mean, on the part of, I think I know the answer, but we've got to talk this through. I'll start. What's your experience from the bench?
Well, Justice Shepard? My comrades tell me there's that unwillingness is not as much a problem as unavailability. That the simple number of people who are trained and willing to do this, trained. I mean, there's a credential HSPP that describes psychologists who do this, and the number of vacancies in states like Indiana and Ohio and Illinois is very substantial. I looked yesterday, and the number of unfilled jobs for which you were required to do that in Indiana was 53. The number in Ohio was 137. So there's a pipeline question, mm-hmm. quite aside from who wants to do diagnoses and who'd rather focus practice in a different direction.
Although one would presume here that if it were, I don't want to use the word lucrative, but enticing enough that people would find a way to do it, or is there another disincentive built into this, Dr. Parker, that
Where should I start? well, I'd like to start with Justice Shepard's comment about availability of mental health professionals. There was a federal report came out a few years back, which showed that Indiana was, I think, 48th in the country in per capita psychiatrists and 45th in the country in per capita PhD-level psychologists. Mm-hmm. And the HSPP essentially is a certification that you have a PhD or a PsyD for psychology. Mm-hmm. So we're underserved as a state for all mental health, at least at the highest level. We do a little bit better with social workers. We're middle of the pack. But doctors in general don't like going to court. Mm-hmm. And it's not on their schedule. And in general, doctors are not real big fans of being cross-examined. So they don't do very well on the stand. And I found fairly early on that I was unusual in that I enjoyed that. I liked mm-hmm. testifying. I think it was in part because I understood that it was a game. And as long as you knew the rules, you shouldn't take it personally. Mm-hmm. A lot of doctors have trouble with that. And the flexibility needed by the courts can sometimes be significant. I started out doing some clinical practice and mostly forensic work here in Indiana. But once I got busy, it was far easier for me just to stop all the clinical because that was one or two days where I couldn't schedule things. And that was awkward at times. Mm-hmm. So it's a challenge. And so in the smaller counties, people do them after hours. They do them on weekends. They squeeze them in because they know the judge or mm-hmm. they've worked out some kind of arrangement. But a lot of those folks are trained as psychiatrists, but not necessarily as forensic psychiatrists, and the same for the psychologist as well. So there is clearly a shortage of folks who are trained in forensic psychiatry and forensic psychology in Indiana, and that's part of the shortage.
Steve, in your reporting on this, I mean, did you find, have there been any other cases similar to this from around the country, or is this sort of an anomaly?
Well, this is an anomaly. I did not check from around the country. Certainly, it's an anomaly in Indiana. And by the way, I really appreciate this today because for the past year, I've been doing this investigation. I've had to explain all the things that these gentlemen have been talking about myself. So I'm actually getting an easy ride today.
Part of it is, you know, it is a complicated question that does involve medical ethics, legal ethics, and all of that. Probably before we go any further, too, I don't think I've established as a baseline, what is the process, Chief Justice Shepherd, if someone is deemed not competent to stand trial? What are the consequences there?
Well, the judge will then send the defendant to the state's Department of Mental Health for further evaluation and an attempt at restoration. Can this person be restored to a level of competence adequate so that he or she can participate in the trial? And that's done on a residential basis. The department then reports back. The first report, I think, is due in 90 days, and it can't go beyond twice that. If it does, then what happens is you begin commitment proceedings, standard mental health commitment proceedings. But that isn't what normally happens. What normally happens is roughly 80% of the time, Dr. Parker confirms, is that this person is restored to a level of capability mm-hmm. and brought back and tried. And, of course, that's what happened in the case of Caleb Loving in Evansville. He sent away to the Logan Sport State Hospital where they work with him for a period of time and then report back that in their opinion he's competent to stand trial, and then the legal process goes forward. There's also another outside limit, which is you can't be held under observation unless you're a risk to yourself and others if you get a standard mental commitment. But you can't be held to be examined beyond the time you could have been in prison for the thing you were charged with, right? So if the charge is, let's say, theft, where you mm-hmm. Couldn't be locked up for more than roughly a year. You can't be held in the hospital for 15 months waiting to see whether you're qualified to go back and go on trial. And you get credit for all the time you're incarcerated as well. So those are the outside limits.
Which creates kind of an interesting conundrum, because we say they're not competent to stand trial, but then we assume that they're ready to reenter inner life at some level, right?
Well, only after the medical community reports to the judge that that's so.
I want to make sure process. I understand. Yeah,
it's a two-step process. So once a defendant is found incompetent to stand trial, they're committed. So it's sort mm-hmm. of like a criminal commitment through the Division of Mental Health and Addiction. And up to 6 months, they stay under the criminal court supervision. After 6 months, with that regular civil commitment, it goes to probate court. They still remain they still keep the legal status of incompetent to stand trial, but they're seen as civilly committed. Mm-hmm. And the discharge decision happens when they're restored mm-hmm. and they get sent back, or they're not restored but they're clinically stable enough to be in the community, and then the hospital will basically wait until the charges go away, because they don't want to be in a position of releasing somebody who has active charges against them. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the maximum sentence comes in. So if you have a level 6 felony, the longest you can be held in jail is 2.5 years. Well, that's the longest you can be held in the state psychiatric hospital while they're attempting to restore you to competence.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Tina. And again, if you want to join the conversation, you can do what Tina has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. On Twitter at WFYI, or you can call us at 866-476-3881. Tina writes, how easy, in the opinion of your experts, is it for someone to feign being mentally incompetent to avoid prison time or worse? Any anecdotal examples? How do you go about ruling out malingering? Dr. Parker, I think we start with you on that one, because you're the one who's got the experience in having to detect that.
Are you sure that listener's not a prosecutor? They always ask that question.
Could be. I don't know. I just know Tina.
Yeah. For a forensic evaluator, that's always an issue, whether somebody may or may not be malingering. That, and malingering is faking your symptoms to try to achieve a goal.
Mm-hmm.
It happens less frequently than people might suspect, at least in my experience. Either that or I'm fooled very regularly. But I think I would find that out from the folks at the state hospital.
Mm-hmm.
They would get that back to me that you know, you're missing things. What the evaluators look for are symptoms that don't fit.
Mm-hmm.
We know what schizophrenia looks like. We know what bipolar disorder looks like. We know what intellectual disability looks like. And when somebody's trying to pretend that they're psychotic or pretend that they're cognitively impaired, unless they know a lot about that condition, it's pretty hard for them to fake it and fake it consistently. And so that's one of the reasons we talk to the attorneys, the defense attorneys. It's one of the reasons we look at the records, because the records may say nothing about psychosis, and yet the guy walks in and says he's hearing voices, and there's this little green man following him around, and all that kind of thing. So there are incentives, but they're usually not very good incentives, because if you go to the state psychiatric hospital, well, if you have a serious mental illness, they're going to help you get better, and then you're going to send you back.
Mm-hmm.
The charges have not gone away.
Well, on some level, too, you're also being detained.
Yes.
Without a trial as well. So,
but you're in a state hospital setting.
Yeah,
it's more pleasant than a
prison.
Although Logansport State Hospital, which is where the very large majority of these folks go, is, well, it's not high security from a DOC standard, but it's high security from our mental health standard. It's fenced all the way around. It's got barbed wire on top of the fence. Yes, you can get outside more frequently, but it's still a locked facility. You're not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I've had one person in my 16 years in Indiana successfully malinger in that he got himself found incompetent to stand trial,
mm-hmm.
got sent to Logansport State Hospital, and then escaped from the hospital while he was off grounds at a medical clinic. And they had not seen hide nor hair of him since then.
What would be the, are there penalties for doing, legal penalties for doing that sort of malingering, or is that, I'll throw that one to Chief Justice Shepard.
Not to my knowledge.
Okay, so.
Yeah.
However, it does not endear you to the prosecutor.
Well, that's probably right.
And that's not a good thing to do.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that Dr. Parker's mentioned that's a key to that, to the malingering question, is that evidence that comes from people who are not trained medical personnel is relevant on the malingering question. So that if a person, an attendant at the hospital, who's observed things, mm-hmm. that suggests malingering, that's admissible evidence and certainly will be provided to the evaluators as well as to the court.
Dr. Parker, you were going to say something, and I cut you off.
No, just to follow on with the justice was saying, is that if somebody successfully malingers and is found incompetent to stand trial on a fraudulent basis and is sent to the state hospital, it's very hard to maintain it in a state hospital setting because they're watching you 24/7. It's really hard to be consistent about lies, and these folks eventually get caught.
It's probably not just prosecutors. I think a judge would be justified in taking into account at sentencing whether you had been cooperative or uncooperative with the system, or whether you'd cost others time and money and taken up a bed from somebody who really needed the help when you didn't.
Well, and again, to sort of get into the legal technicalities too, if that's the case and that person has to testify in her or his own defense, can that be used in any way to undermine the quality of the testimony? I know that's a complicated question.
I'd have to think about that.
Think about it. Okay, well, yeah. I'll tell you what. We've got a break coming up here, so we got a little bit of time to walk through this. We are talking about a pretty complicated legal issue, medical issue, ethical issue today, revolving around the question of competence and how we determine it when it comes to court cases. My guests are public media reporter Steve Berger of WNIN, former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randall Shepard, and Dr. George Parker of the IU Department of Psychiatry. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're having a fascinating conversation, springing from some fine reporting by our friends at Side Effects on fraudulent mental health reporting in the courts. My guests are public media reporter Steve Berger of WNIN, who did the reporting, former Chief Justice Randall Shepard, and Dr. George Parker of the IU Department of Psychiatry. Steve, I do want to drive people to your other stories. We played the one at the top, but the other one really illuminates the fact that there is some doubt about whether Dr. Fink ever would have been caught if he hadn't, in effect, kind of self-identified here and run his 2012 BMW. I thought that was a nice detail in the reporting, by the way. 2012.
He had a personalized BMW license plate, Scotia. By the way. Scotia.
Into a tree. If that hadn't happened, you know, this might not have been discovered at all. Is there concern following this that the safeguards, that there aren't adequate safeguards in place to make sure this doesn't happen in the future?
There is definitely concern about that from the people in the system, including Dr. Parker, frankly, that I interviewed for the series, that someone could write a report and no one could tell whether they actually saw the patient or not. Mr. Owens, the defense attorney, said it in that interview. I had that, again, as I mentioned, I had that conversation with Dr. Parker, but also the prosecutor in Vandenberg County. I talked to the prosecutor and defense attorney in Martin County. They all say some version of the same thing. We don't know. We can't understand the reports. There's no overall standard way that the report is written, and we don't know. And they freely admit that. They freely admit that, the attorneys.
Is this one of those cases, too, where you know, I remember in a previous life I was executive director of what was the Indiana Civil Liberties Union for a few years, and I remember being on a panel dealing with the death penalty, and one of the other panelists made the argument that at some level the death penalty, because the stakes are so high, makes sure that cases are going to get tremendous scrutiny all the way through the process. It's the lower level cases that we don't have to worry about as much here. Dr. Parker, I hear you, or we do have to worry about more, excuse me, I misspoke. We have to worry about because people do tend to just move them along through the system. You know, in Steve's report, they said they look at, the lawyers often look at the reports and they don't understand them.
Oh, that's disappointing to hear. Yeah. I work pretty hard on my reports. Mm-hmm. They're pretty long, mm-hmm. by I think the Indiana standards, 5 to 6 pages, single spaced. I put in pretty much everything that I learn, in mm-hmm. part because I will not remember that person the following week because mm-hmm. I will have done another 4 or 5 evaluations in the meantime. Mm-hmm. So if I'm called to testify, I rely on my report to say, okay, this is this person. There are mental health professionals in Indiana who write reports rather differently for the courts, in which they answer the court's question mm-hmm. and provide a minimum amount of data to support that opinion. And that kind of report would be pretty easy to write if you know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And where you would probably, you're answering the question, but you're not giving the supporting information. That would be very hard to pick up as to whether that was fake or not. The more information that goes into the report, the more likely it could be identified as false, because the person reading it, I mean, it could be the defendant, and ideally the defendant should read the report and say, hey, I never met this guy. I never told him anything like that. Mm-hmm. He never had me do this test. So, if there's the least question, the defense attorney should go over the report with the defendant to see if there is that factual inconsistency. Otherwise, I mean, if the lawyers just look at the summary and the opinion in the summary, which I suspect a lot of them do, they're not going to tell. They're not going to be able to figure it out.
Go ahead, Steve.
If I could for just a moment. In the case of Caleb Loving and his defense attorney, Stephen Owens, who is an experienced public defender, he's been doing it since 1995. What was really scary about that is that Steve Owens says, I was ready for him. We had our own expert look at the report, and she showed some areas that were problems in that report. I found out that he had the jail record showed he hadn't necessarily seen my client. I was going to cross-examine him at length in this trial, and I still asked that question, and he said, maybe. That's the scary part, I think, that for a lot of people when they hear something like that.
Well, and it seems to me like some of this, you know, one of the way they went back and verified that it couldn't be is that they found out that he'd not made a visit to the jail. Are there certain sort of basic state safeguards that we could build into the system that that you have to provide proof that you actually met with, or would that you're shaking your head, Dr. Parker?
No, they're not there. It largely works on an honor system.
But I guess what I'm saying is, should we institute something like that? Don't worry, I'm coming to Chief Justice Shepherd in a second here to talk about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it goes to how frequent is this?
Yeah.
And frankly, I was stunned when I heard about this. This is just such an anomaly for, I mean, it's so outside the bounds of what's accepted behavior for a psychologist or a psychiatrist or any medical professional. And this is outright fraud.
Yeah.
To the courts, where you're holding yourself out as an expert witness, which is putting yourself in a somewhat exposed position, which is why he felt so guilty about being forced to testify. He knew he was in deep, deep trouble. And I know I would never want to be in that position, and I suspect all of my colleagues would say I would never want to be the one sitting on the stand saying, actually, I didn't see him, because then you're done.
Yeah.
You're never doing another evaluation.
And also I would think that there's probably some professional consequences as well about
The licensee board will be interested in that. The prosecutor will be very unhappy with you, and you could easily get charged for that. Most of the folks who do these, I think, have sterner ethical standards than Dr. Frank. I mean, obviously they do, because he had none. So in that sense, you're looking for a needle in a haystack by instituting stricter standards. But it also suggests that, well, we, the people doing these evaluations, we could do a better job writing the reports so that it's more transparent where the information is coming from, and that makes it verifiable.
So, Chief Justice Shepherd, I promised I was going to ask this question at one point, in part because this does seem to be at least a relative anomaly, although, you know, in some ways saying no one else has ever done this puts us in the position of trying to prove a negative, too. So we have to assume that, you know, that there is a possibility. But, you know, lawyers have that saying that bad cases make bad laws. Is this one of those situations where we should just say it's an anomaly and that the system fundamentally works, or there are other safeguards that perhaps we ought to look at or consider?
Well, I have learned about one that by reading Steve Berger's stories. I would, by the way, say that I don't hear judges and lawyers say to me, I don't understand these reports. I mean, there are different levels of expertise. I don't expect people from other disciplines to readily understand the terms of art and the development of them in the legal system. Just as I readily confess, I don't understand the underlying research background education required to reach medical conclusions. So do we. But I don't hear a lot of lawyers and judges say, I read these reports and I don't understand them. There probably are people who say that. It's not been my experience. I think a good place to start is the one known case that is, and I know in fact that the judges and the lawyers have been looking at these other cases that Steve Berger mentions in which Dr. Fink was involved. to see what they can learn about whether is this an anomaly. If it is, if it's not, and I guess there are some, I guess 29, I think you said, where they're not sure whether he saw the defendant or not. The big question would be, how many of these do we think the wrong conclusion was reached in terms of the final answer? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is out of the, it'd be more than 29, right, in which he'd participated. It'd be more like a couple of score over a recent period of time. If you look at all those carefully and with expert medical and legal eyes, and you can't find anybody else who might have had a wrong determination, then I think you decide that putting a felony conviction on Dr. Fink might be a good enough answer. Mm-hmm. But if you were to go through them and find a bunch of questions where you thought maybe the wrong result had been reached, then you might want to talk about some of the other safeguards, one of which is mentioned by Steve Berger.
Well, that the only issue there, logically, correct me if I'm wrong on this, it'd have to be in situations where he said the defendant was competent, right? Presumably, because if he said no,
yeah, those would be the ones you'd look most carefully
because,
at.
So
that's
it would
the
be,
ones you'd worry about.
Because then the trial would have proceeded on a possibly false assumption, mm-hmm. correct? And in that case, what's the legal – I mean, are those – you know, what would be the standard for declaring something like that a mistrial or setting aside the verdict? And I presume you start all over again, right? I know that's a difficult question. Actually, it's about three questions in one. I apologize. But
well,
I am curious about
there
this.
There absolutely are avenues. We have an entire system. And one of the biggest law offices in Indiana, the state public defender, is charged with going back and looking for the needles in the haystack, try to find people who, not just on these grounds, but on other grounds, didn't get a fair trial, didn't have an adequate legal protection. And I have every confidence that it would be a legally recognizable claim that I shouldn't have gone to trial in the first place. Now, mind you, most of the folks to do this don't go to trial anyway.
Yeah.
They are people like Mr. Loving, who isn't apparently going to go to trial.
Yeah,
he's going to take a couple of felony convictions, I gather. Steve Berger probably knows I was unable to determine whether the plea bargains that have been entered mm-hmm. call for a specific term or whether that's going to be left to the trial judge who hears the plea, but mm-hmm. In the case we're talking about, there's really nothing so far to suggest that he wasn't competent on the day he was first declared competent, or competent on the day when he decided to plead guilty.
Steve,
so you want to know a lot about those.
Yeah.
What's the incidents involved? It seems to me.
I think the Chief Justice has given you a cue here, Steve.
Well, I don't know if in the plea bargain. That's a great question. They actually did that last Friday late mm-hmm. afternoon. But, John, I can give you a little bit of breaking news, the Chief Justice spoke about the Indiana public defender. And I was told yesterday by Mary Willis, who's the court administrator now for the Supreme Court, that, indeed, in this case, it's an odd enough one. It's enough of an outlier that the public defender's office has notified and has contacted the defendants in those 29 cases, those other 28 cases, actually,
mm-hmm.
and advised them of their rights with the conviction of Dr. Fink, who performed the evaluations in those cases.
So this this story, then, could be far from over.
It is. It's far from over.
Yeah, and by the way, in most states and in the federal system, you don't have an automatic right to have a lawyer review your case after the fact. Mm-hmm. Indiana is a place where every single convicted, incarcerated person has the right to the services of a lawyer to examine his or her case, and that's a good thing for Indiana to be proud of. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Parker, we talked about this earlier, but this sort of revolves, this area we're talking about now kind of revolves around this question of how often are people deemed incompetent to stand trial? I know you said you might have some figures for Marion County, if not for the whole state.
Right. Well, I think going back to Justice Shepard's point earlier in the show, this is a rare evaluation. Competence to stand trial does not come up frequently. I do mm-hmm. about 120 court-ordered evaluations in Marion County in a given year.
Mm-hmm.
Marion County does 30, 40, 50,000 criminal cases in a year, I think.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a very small percentage of the overall number of cases in any county. I don't know the official outcomes from the courts. I don't keep score, mm-hmm. so to speak, because I don't want to be biased about how I do my evaluations.
Yeah.
But I do keep track of my opinions, mm-hmm. and in my opinion, it's about 1 in 3 for a defendant to be incompetent to stand trial. So for Marion County, that would be 1/3 of 120. That's about 40 people a year that I think might not be competent to stand trial. And then the other evaluator has to agree, and, well, more importantly, the judge has to agree. And then they go into the state psychiatric system. So it's a very small part of the criminal justice system, but it involves people who are arguably at the most risk in the criminal justice system, because these are typically people who have a serious mental illness or a significant cognitive impairment. And the criminal justice system is not a good place to be if you're impaired, and that's why the competence to stand trial, that's why the standard exists in the first place.
Yeah, the criminal justice system's focus really isn't therapeutic.
Not always.
No. No, but, I mean, it really is about public safety much more than anything else. So, Steve, we're getting close on time here in terms of this. Are you doing more reporting on this, and where is this story going to go next, do you think?
Well, we will be trying to get comment about the rest of those cases now, the rest of the 29 cases. Also, Dr. Parker had offered a solution of sorts, and mm-hmm. it's in the second part of that series mm-hmm. about some certification and review that might help the court system.
Well, is it possible to lay out what that solution would be in about 45 seconds?
I can try.
Okay.
So many states have a centralized process for becoming a forensic evaluator. It involves basic certification, some requirement for updates and training, and submission of reports, not just to the courts, but also to the central authority as a quality assurance measure. And obviously you have to set up standards for a system like that to work. Indiana has been decentralized in that sense for many years. But the Indiana Judicial Center might do something like that. I don't know. It's just a hypothesis. It would be another layer of regulation, and that might make it harder to recruit. So there's good and bad with everything.
Well, what this tells me, and I feel like we could have talked for at least another 2 hours on this and still had things to discuss at the end of it. I hope as the story progresses, you'd all consider coming back and talking with us again about it. I'd like to thank my guests, Steve Berger, former Indiana Chief Justice Randall Shepard, and Dr. George Parker, the IU Department of Psychiatry, for what has been a fascinating conversation. We will be back here on Thursday when we're going to be talking about the Central Library's 100th anniversary. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.